Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hey guys, just a quick note here before we start the show. We've had a lot of people recently asking what's a good way to support the podcast. We so appreciate this enthusiasm from our listeners to do whatever they can to help us out. And we understand that we're in a pretty unique situation. For anyone who doesn't know, the vast majority, around 80 to 90% of podcast downloads usually comes from iTunes. And that's why your favorite podcasters are always saying, you know, go review us on iTunes, but they're not saying anything anywhere else. We, because we were featured on Podcast Addict's trending section for a few weeks, heck, we might still even be there, we actually have more than 40% of our traffic coming from Podcast Addict and other Android platforms that don't have access to the iTunes store to leave a rating, leave a review. Now, there are still other ways that you can support the podcast. You know, the best one, of course, is just telling your friends. The other good one to do is if you want to look at maybe supporting us on Patreon, that sounds fantastic to us. If you think that the value you get from the podcast is worth any value back. But we understand how hard you work for your money, and we're not going to ask you to part with a single dollar that you don't want to. So we actually have this other really great way that you can help the show. And it's just to head on over. There's a survey set up. It's survey.libsyn.com/notalonepodcast. We're trying to do a demographic survey to gather a little more information on our listeners. And if you could head over there and take this survey, it would help us immensely. We're looking, we want to get around 250 responses. The last time we checked, we were at about 20. So if you're able to go over there, again, that's survey.libsyn.com/notalonepodcast. It literally takes you 25 seconds. We timed it. Takes you 25 seconds and it will support the show so fantastically well. But of course, even if you don't want to do all of that, we're just happy you're our listener. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And today we are talking about probably one of my absolute favorite pieces of mythology and folklore. One of the things that has interested me ever since I was a very young child.
Yeah, we're talking about hellhounds. Why do you like them so much?
I really like hellhounds. For a few reasons. One of which is, I believe that at one point in my life, I saw one. That was a scary, scary experience. I really like hellhounds because they have this sort of like, and you're going to get into it, I know, but this feeling of like, well, it's man's best friend, but it's also, I really like psychopomps. Like anything that's a psychopomp is automatically something I love. So like Charon, Float in the River Styx, Anubis, anything that's meant to transport the souls of the dead into the next life, which the majority of psychopomps are usually, while they're frightening, they're usually friendly, or at least, like, ambivalent. Like,
yeah,
Chiron's
neutral.
He's not making fun of you or attacking you, but the hellhound,
they don't mess around.
No, they're a vicious...
They're coming for you.
Yeah, vicious, terrifying, rip business. You from this life sort of deal.
Yeah, and I think
they're fascinating.
Is it anything like, you know, wolf people? Is the same kind of like ancestral connection?
I do.
Thing as well.
As I was doing the research for this, I really realized how deeply stories of canine beings affect me and how, like, that's my trigger. Anything that has to do
with puppies, Sam, gets triggered.
Exactly. Except sometimes the puppies are evil and malignant, but...
Right, and eat your face off.
Exactly, and those are the things that spook me more than anything. And I really like the stuff that spooks me, which is why, like, the Wolfmen, Skinwalkers.
Yeah, Skinwalkers in general are just kind of
they scare
freaky.
Me. They scare me so much, but I feel compelled. I have to learn more and know more because they scare me so much and they become my favorite things. Hellhounds is exactly like that for me.
So, dear listeners, in case you haven't picked up on it, Hellhounds are essentially these spectral beasts that come for the living.
They're coming for you.
Essentially, kill you. So they come for your soul. At least that's more in the kind of the pop culture feel that we have now, again, because of a show that we reference quite frequently, Supernatural.
Supernatural.
Yes! Yep. Or they're invisible dogs that essentially come for the souls of folks that unfortunately made deals with demons.
Poor life choices.
Yeah, and the fun thing with that one is that they're invisible, which is not fun at all.
That's true.
Probably the worst aspect of it. But we've seen things like hellhounds throughout our history. Some of them have taken the shape of Cerberus, having three heads. But cultures around the world have also had their own versions of it. For example, the Inuits.
Amarok.
Have a giant lone wolf. This is going to work out great.
Yeah, this is going to be great.
A giant lone wolf that stalks solitary hunters. First off, things that clip in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh darn dire wolf.
Right, well, and it may be, that's the, with the Amarok especially, that's kind of what it's associated with, is simply a currently extinct wolf species that was just larger and more vicious than the current wolf species that we
know. I mean, dire wolves were a real thing, they're not just in Game of Thrones.
Isn't it great?
It's amazing. It's so amazing, but terrifying at the same time. Also, Japanese myth and culture, which is
Inugami.
Thank you, buddy. is a type of spirit dog that actually possesses the bodies of his victims, which is, we got a mix of different mythos right there, where we have spiritual possession and mankind's best friend.
Yes.
So probably, you know, the one thing that I feel like we're the closest to in nature.
Yeah.
Of course, I already mentioned it, name drop there for Cerberus.
Cerberus.
Being the guard dog for Hades down the underworld.
The original good boy.
And then we also have Central and South American cultures that also have their own, which is the
Cadejo.
Thank you.
Yeah. The Cadejo is interesting because it splits. It's something that is supposed to be encountered by travelers traveling alone late at night, which is such a common theme in Hellhound culture or lore.
Well, I mean, that's such a common theme in folklore around the world.
Never be
travelers
alone.
At night.
Yeah,
alone.
Never be
those
alone.
Those three
that's
things are no-nos.
That's the story. But the Cadejo.
If you learn anything from this podcast, don't do those three things.
Just don't do it. But the Cadejo, it's a dog with goat hooves. And
how interesting.
Yeah, and it splits. You have a black Cadejo and a white Cadejo, and their roles are mixed up depending on the tribes and the peoples that you're speaking to. But one of them, primarily the black one, is meant to be like a servant of the devil or the devil itself, and it will kill you, and then the white Cadejo will lead you to safety and protect you. So very like angels
yin
and
yang.
Yeah, yin and yang.
And I mean, speaking of black dogs, those are probably the most common that we have now.
Yes.
And that has popped up fairly recently in Europe as the primary hellhound. As we break down a little bit more, mainly in Great Britain and Wales. Mm-hmm. Are black dogs being seen, and they can be omens as well, which is also kind of cool and kind of weird at the same time.
Well, the black dog is the typical European idea of a hellhound, but they're not always associated together. Sometimes the black dog is simply just a ghost dog or a spectral dog, but other times it's meant especially to drag or lead its victims into the afterlife. It's been around forever. I mean, the very first hellhound legend or black dog legend dates all the way back to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is a collection of writings that go back as far as the 9th century and then are updated and added to all the way up until the 12th century. It's essentially a record book for the early Anglo-Saxon people. And the first documented sighting of the black dog comes from this book in 1127. There was a large black dog that was seen accompanying what's known as the Wild Hunt, which all of our gamer listeners
have been popularized by The Witcher.
The Witcher, yeah. The Wild Hunt was a group of evil spirits or malevolent fairies that were seen riding across the sky or white riding across the land. The hunt was often just a simple portent of doom, but otherwise they would abduct people and take them from the physical realm into the fairy world or the underworld. Other times, as...
Gosh darn fairies, man.
Oh, man, you don't mess with them. Other times, as the hunt was riding past, for instance, if you were asleep in bed and the hunt rode past your home, your soul would be ripped from your body and you would join the hunt, essentially.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah, it is intense. The term wasn't popularized until Jacob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm included it in a publication in 1835, and that's where the black dog stories of European folklore really begin.
So, as Sam was doing all this wonderful research about black dogs, about hellhounds in general, I decided to take a step back, and I wanted to take a peek at dogs in general, because for the longest time, we'd like to think that mankind kind of domesticated the dog.
Right.
But I found a lot of research that kind of provides different information.
Really?
And also kind of ties the idea that dogs, wolves, and death together. So if we go back about 30,000 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I didn't pack for that.
I know. So come with me now. 30,000 years ago, we actually have evidence with dog skulls versus wolf skulls is how scientists have, for the most part, figured it out, just the differences, and also in genome, because the farther down the line that two different species split, the more changes there's going to be. So originally, I think we all like to think that mankind went out, found a wolf pup,
right,
brought him home and raised him.
Right.
But that actually kind of goes against what we have found. So there's the most popular theory about domestication of the dog, and it was also probably our first domesticated animal, is that we are just really inefficient at cleaning our kills.
Like, that's fair.
That's what it comes down to. So about 30,000 years ago, we started having really good tools, really good hunting equipment. So as you can imagine, hunting parties going out, making large animal kills, say like a mammoth or something, we can't bring all that food back to the tribe. That's just, it's impossible to clean an entire carcass. And as a large predator, like wolves, that are also fairly smart, they are plenty fine with scavenging.
Right.
Because if they scavenge a kill that mankind made, cool. That means they're not endangering themselves and making their own kill. So we actually have wolves kind of following us and staying near our own nomadic tribes and encampments, and just essentially cleaning up after our scraps, including our dead.
Oh, man.
So, and actually, fast forward quite farther away, just a little side note here, early Persian civilization actually used dogs as a way to dispose of their dead as well.
Really?
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
Really interesting, yeah.
Phenomenally cool.
Yeah.
And gory and awful at the same time. Slowly, the more friendly wolves, the ones that weren't nearly as aggressive, came closer and closer to our encampments, and we started feeding them more and more. So it was more of the dogs coming to us and domesticating themselves than rather us going out to nature and plucking a pup and raising it as it is. So we have the ones that are the friendly wolves becoming the ones that are more successful, because as we are more successful, they are. So they breed quicker than what the aggressive hunting dogs or hunting wolves do.
All right.
So slowly, over time, the progression becomes more and more and more, and eventually they become a part of our society. But for a long time, and we've already touched on it, dire wolves were a thing.
Right.
For a very long time,
right.
We were not the apex predator.
No.
Wolves were absolutely associated with death for us for most of our history. So that also shows us the predation that we experienced ancestrally to the eventual domestication of man's best friend. So we get this kind of weird collaboration of death and friendship, and it absolutely ties our ancestral tree together.
Yeah.
Also, fun fact, apparently we domesticated the dog twice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
So I'm going to break it down for
you.
Okay.
Break it down.
There is a species of European wolf
that
was domesticated earlier before the Asian wolves were. Now, I'm saying this because all dogs today are descendants of Asian wolves. There was a European wolf that we had domesticated independently and actually before the Asian wolf. But those species eventually died out because the Asian wolves became more popular later on.
Okay.
I guess they're just better genetics for domestication.
Okay.
Yeah, so us and wolves and domestication, it's all crazy.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. It sounds, you should kind of look into.
You should write a book on that. That would be a fascinating book. I'm sure there are other books.
I should just do like a 7-minute YouTube channel. There you go. That's really what it should be. But yeah, and I think that plays a huge role of where the idea of hellhounds came from.
Right.
And with that kind of pickup in ancient times and ancient folklore of these hellhounds, it again kind of comes back around to inspire what we have today, mm-hmm. and the ideas and
yeah.
stuff.
Dang. You did your homework. That
yeah,
was
dude.
Impressive.
I like dogs.
Yeah. No. I think one of my
cats suck.
Hey, now, don't be mean.
I'm sorry. Cats are okay. Smilodon is super cool. I will absolutely side with Smilodon over a dire wolf any day.
I don't know what a Smilodon is.
It's a saber-toothed cat.
Oh, okay. One of my favorite things.
The biggest.
So, Baron, my little boy over there.
Baron's a dog.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's my son.
I'm clarifying for everyone else.
He is my child, and I love him. So Baron, he's, for anyone who somehow doesn't know, as in doesn't follow me on Twitter, Facebook, anywhere, and this is your first time listening to the podcast, because I think I mention him almost every show, he's a little miniature dachshund, and he's the love of my life. And don't tell my wife. And I have for him this little plaid sweater we put on him in the winter because it gets chilly outside. And my favorite thing is that when I'm walking him and he's wearing this plaid sweater and he's on his leash, I just look at him and I think of the wolves that he was descended from and how just disgusted that he
look
must
what
be
we
with
did.
Him. Yeah.
We ruined it.
He's a good boy. Anyway, well, that was really, that was interesting.
Yeah,
I
mean,
no idea.
Hopefully. A topic to talk about, like a next dinner or something.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. That's a great rundown on how dogs and wolves and all that were associated with death. And that most likely plays, I mean, it almost definitely plays a huge part of this folklore. Now, we're going to be talking about one specific hellhound that really fits the bill for it here in a moment. The actual subject for the show tonight is the Hound of Mons, which is one specific hellhound. But like I said, this black dog legend and folklore has been around, written down almost 1,000 years at this point, 900 and whatever years. So there's one other story that I really want to talk about here that I found that's just amazing. It's one of the most well-known stories of like a black dog, and it also ties very well into the hellhound mythology, and that is Old Shuck or Black Shuck from Great Britain.
Which I feel like we should just be listening to Led Zeppelin this entire time.
I know.
can you edit that in? Put that into the background the entire time on a loop.
I would, but I can't because I really don't want to get sued by my favorite
band. And copyright
band.
And stuff.
That
yeah, that makes sense. That
would be really sad.
Well, everyone, listen to it beforehand and just keep it like on replay in your head.
Yeah, or just like have the podcast going on one speaker and listen to Black Dog on the other speaker by Led Zeppelin. It'll be the same effect. You just have to do a little more work for it, dear listener. So we're going to talk here really quickly about Black Shuck, who is one of the most famous hellhounds of all time and fits the bill for both the Black Dog legend as well as the hellhound legend. Now, in England, the Black Dog, like I said, it often appears just as a ghostly dog or a spectral being. It appears late at night on
I kind of feel like it's a lot like a black cat kind of a feel.
It is,
where
yeah.
It's kind of ominous in a way, especially if you see it at night.
Yeah, yeah. They're both portents of doom, but I think that the black dog is a more active portent, whereas the black cat is passive. Mm-hmm. You see a black cat, the black cat itself doesn't do anything to you, but the black dog will. And the best account of Black Shuck and hellhounds in general, I would say, comes to us from 1577 in the county of Suffolk. Now, on August 4th of that year, this dog, Black Shuck, was seen in two different churches and two different parishes, one of those being in Bungay and the other in Blythburgh. Now, in Blythburgh, it's said that Black Shuck stormed into the Holy Trinity Church just in time with a deafening clap of thunder that had just rung out.
That's not ominous.
Right. He immediately leapt at a young boy and at a man, biting them both in the throat and killing them instantly. Not even killing them like, you know, if something rips
like
out your
bled
throat
out,
and it bleeds
it,
out, or you can't
they went limp instantly.
He's just, they're just dead. Now,
like
as...
he ripped out their soul.
Exactly. As the boy and the man died, the church steeple collapsed through the roof. On his way out, he scratches the north door of the church, which leaves deep gouges in them that appear also to be scorched. The cool thing about this is almost 500 years later, 440 years later, you can still see these gouges. They're still there at the Holy Trinity Church in Blytheburg, and they're referred
Wait,
to...
Wait, it collapsed, though.
Well, the steeple collapsed, but the door was fine. They just had to rebuild the steeple.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and it does. It's you can see very clearly gouging and scratches that are blackened and burned. And locally, these are known as the devil's fingerprints. Now, later that day...
How many, do you know how many claw marks?
I'm trying to picture it in my head. I think there's like 3 or 4.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah.
Because there should be 4.
Okay. There we go. See? It lines up. It lines up.
There should be 4.
Now, later that day, in the parish of Bungay, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that wrong, everybody, at St. Mary's Church, Black Shuck struck again, and was reported once again to attack 2 of the parishioners at the throat, killing them both, and then immediately leaving the church. But I think one of the most interesting things about Shuck is that he wasn't always malignant. And in fact, one of the earliest accounts I could find of him comes from pre-Reformation times, back before the 1500s, when there was a large black dog that was killed defending a young woman from a friar who was attempting to rape her. Now, this...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I haven't found anybody else with this theory.
That's a beautiful little connection there.
Yeah. I haven't found anybody else with this theory, but this is my official theory on Black Shuck. I mean, a friar is supposed to be... For anybody who doesn't know, they're essentially a monk, a member of a Franciscan order. Is it possible that this dog was defending this young woman from what was supposed to be a holy man, but turned out to be a monster? He dies, and then he spends the rest of his existence going around
exacting revenge,
and seeing, like, you know, those 4 people that he killed back in 1577. What if, yeah, they're in church, they're praying and all that, but what if they were actually terrible monsters of people just masquerading as good church-going people? So
it's beautiful story.
It is a beautiful
story. It's a great
story.
Idea. I mean, it's eloquent. It's easy. Great connection there. I like your theory. I like your theory, Sam.
You.
That's what I'm getting at.
I think it's a good theory.
It's a great theory.
I
hope it's in a book somewhere.
I'm going to write
a fictional
book.
With
it. Yeah.
No offense.
Stop it.
But
you're okay.
It's perfect. Right. You know,
it is.
It's a very nice, neat theory.
Yeah. But that's the thing.
Of an immortal dog.
Is I came up with that theory. Like, that wasn't, like, a big, widespread theory about it. Or
yeah.
I'm sure somebody else has come up with that theory. And the dog, like I said, was killed. So it wouldn't be that the dog is immortal. It would be that it's a spiritual being going around extracting revenge. But in any case, Black Shuck and other spectral black dogs have been around since time immemorial. But there's one specific hound that we want to talk to you about today. Like I said, the Hound of Mons, who stalked the no man's land of World War I. Now, today's story comes from a particularly bloody battle near the beginning of World War I, the Battle of Mons. Now, this was an engagement between the British and German forces that took place in the small Belgian village of Mons. It was taken by the Germans early on in the war, and the British were essentially attempting to reclaim the village. As those of us who paid attention in history class will know, World War I mean, it changed war. It was a whole new world. One of the major things that made it a whole new battlefield was the battlefield itself, trench warfare, in which both sides, they dig the trench, live in the trench, fire from the trench, defend in the trench. You've got, on both sides, giant machine guns just spraying bullets. You've got artillery. You have also in World War I, really, the advent of chemical weapons.
Yeah, which sucks.
terrible, like terrible. And there's a great episode by a fellow named Jake Barton. It's his second most recent episode. His podcast is Historium. It talks about the man who really brought chemical weapons to the forefront. And it's amazing. So check that out if you want to know exactly how terrible they are.
Yeah, war crimes, baby.
Yeah.
Gotta love them.
But this trench warfare mindset introduced an entirely new designation on the battlefield, and that is no man's land. This was the land between trenches, which was constantly under watch of snipers, machine gunners, artillery specialists. Usually it also had mines in it.
Raiders everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, and it's called no man's land because no man would go there, because if you're dead, you're dead. That's yeah. about
you're
it.
Not making it very far. And that is what brought trench warfare to be, you know, gains of inches
right.
instead of, you know, miles. Gains of miles. And it was just a slow, agonizing experience. That and most of the trenches were just filled with water and waste. Mm-hmm. So we had issues like trench foot, which is literally just like your foot rotting away.
Yeah.
And that was extremely common on both sides. It's absolutely horrible. Brutal to think about. And I mean,
it was a truly brutal and terrible way of fighting a war and a terrible way to die. And if there was a place where I would say a modern day hellhound was
roaming,
most likely to hang out carrying souls to the afterlife, it would be no man's land.
Yeah. And I mean,
trenches. And that's the, I guess the setting of today's story. Now, the story of the Hound of Mons comes from, we only have one verifiable source, and that is a Canadian war veteran by the name of F.J. Newhouse. He was enlisted with the London Fusiliers during this time period. Now, at one point, he says that a patrol of five men, one Captain Yeskis and his subordinates, were ordered to patrol No Man's Land, looking into the possible advancements of the Allied troops, which that is the pretty much the only time anyone would go into No Man's Land is trying to see, okay, how can we get forward? How can we get those inches, get those feet?
And then sniper.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Usually.
And that's the thing is that, of course, his patrol did not return. And this was unfortunately normal in those times. But the abnormalities began when just days later, the bodies of the missing patrol were found and their throats had been ripped out. And there were chunks of flesh missing from the corpses. A few days later, soldiers from both fronts, both the German and the British, reported hearing a monstrous, beastly howling coming from the darkness of No Man's Land. There were also reports coming from the men in the trenches of a great beast with glowing red eyes that snapped at the barbed wire in the night, and men were periodically found in the same condition as Captain Yeskis and his men, with their throats ripped out and partially devoured. The other interesting thing here is that it wasn't simply the British side that was suffering from this. They would hear in the middle of the night screaming coming up from the German side, the German front, seeming to imply that the Hellhound was attacking the other side as well. And around this time, people start to get a good look of it as well. You have the sentries who are set to guard that field, that no man's land in the night, and they reported seeing just an enormous gray hound that they described as skulking through in and out of the shadows of no man's land in the night. And then suddenly, one day, it says 2 years later, but the thing about the Battle of Mons is it didn't last 2 years. So what we're forced to assume is that the Hellhound hung out in the area, essentially, you know, the Battle of the Battle of Mons, then the Battle of Marnes, the Battle of Ypres, that it was following the armed forces from one place to the other. And this veteran, Captain Newhouse, states that wherever they were going, they would hear almost nightly these just earth-piercing, world-shattering howls. They would see the beast in the darkness. They would lose men continuously. Day after day, they would find it, and especially it seemed to escalate and escalate and escalate, and then suddenly, it just stops. The howling stops, the dead corpses stop, and the interesting thing is that it doesn't say exactly what day, but it is mentioned that around the same time as the Hellhound disappears, that's when the German defensive, or the German army, goes on the defensive instead of the offensive. Because technically, like, technically the British lost the Battle of Mons and were forced to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it said that through the last 2 to 3 years of the war, the Germans didn't have another monumental victory. And that's where it comes in that, you know, maybe this Hellhound was a German creation.
That's, I'm going to pause you for a quick second and let's roll back a little bit. So the Hellhound monitoring no man's land,
mm-hmm.
Reminds me a lot about what I already kind of talked about with dogs and wolves scavenging off of humans.
Yeah.
Makes a ton of sense. And usually when someone is killed by a dog or a, mm-hmm. a wolf, of course the neck is the prime the prime target for killing. But after that, it's usually the stomachs that are eaten out first.
Okay.
Essentially the really soft tissues. And then outward. So having big chunks of flesh ripped apart makes a ton of sense. And this mm-hmm. could just be opportunistic attacks on soldiers.
Yeah, but...
Because it's not like they wouldn't have the ability to sniff out mines themselves.
Right.
Like, I mean, that was actually one of the things that they were used for in war. Which dogs actually had several different roles. So I actually looked this up too. So besides for, you know, finding mines, explosive, things like that, which we use for today now too, mm-hmm. They're also used as scouts to actually patrol ahead of troops as they're going into new territories. Sentries, of course, makes a lot of mm-hmm. sense. And also as essentially medics in no man's land. So dogs were actually sent out to find wounded and injured soldiers and essentially bring them back, which is incredible. They're angels of the battlefield is what they used to be. So it's not far-fetched to have a large wolf, which wolves have been seen more and more in the Belgian area now, which is awesome. And it doesn't seem too far-fetched to have a wolf with red eyes. You gotta think, like, all the dirt, the smoke that's probably involved with no man's land. I mean, for reference, let's see, Blackbeard went into combat with smoke around his head, his eyes bloodshot from Wicks. What are they called? Help me. Fuses, yes, because he had fuses stuffed in his hat and draping around his face lit up. It made him look like a demon.
What the hell? That's amazing.
Yeah, Blackbeard.
I've never heard that.
Blackbeard was super cool.
That's crazy.
So, you know, with the same kind of thing happening on the battlefield, it's not hard to kind of reach for the Hellhound being this immensely big dog that is just scavenging and well, being the predator of no man's land and taking advantage of that.
I think for me, one of the things about it, and granted, you do have dogs that were used in war, most definitely. But I think one of the biggest things is even if a dog can sniff out mines, even if it's able to survive no man's land, I mean, you just have to think you've got literal rockets and missiles firing at all hours of the night. You have machine guns firing at all hours of the night. So the first thing is, while it can sniff out mines, how does it avoid being shot? And the second thing is, I mean, even feral dogs, because obviously, this isn't a dog that was trained by the United States, and in theory, it's not one that's trained by the Germans either, because it is attacking the German
right,
people.
It's being opportunistic on both sides.
Yeah. How is it, why is it not seeking shelter and running away from these sounds of gunfire and all of that? You know, wolves are, we've talked about it before, wolves are skittish creatures. They don't necessarily enjoy being surprised. They don't enjoy civilization and all of that. So it's very strange to me that it would hang out.
I think what it comes down to is one particular animal identifying the risk difference between opportunity and the risk of being out there. And it's absolutely plausible that a dog would be able to hear artillery fire coming at them.
Right.
And that's the difference with us and them, is that they have much higher senses for that. Hearing, smell. They would be able to last in no man's land a lot longer than what we would be able to.
Yeah. Well, and then you have the other weird thing about it, is it like following, essentially, which, like you said earlier, follow the dead. But still, I don't know. It's a little weird for it to be like just a normal dog. I think the descriptions and all that.
You know, I wouldn't say it'd be a normal dog. It reminds me a lot of, you know, the Beast of Gavedon.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that is, you know, maybe a cross between a dog and a wolf or something that is not necessarily what we'd expect to find, you know, hanging out at the dog park.
Right, right.
Or just, you know, a very, very aggressive and solo wolf.
All right.
Could be a possibility. Anyway, there is another possibility that we're going to talk about right now.
I was going to say, that's a good theory. Those are good ideas. But that's not what history has remembered this as. So we spoke a moment ago, the primary source for this, and the only one I was able to find. Now, I'm not saying that there's not another source out there. The only one I was able to find is a Canadian war veteran named F.J. Newhouse. So he has his own idea on the origin of the house, and he claims that it was not supernatural in the slightest, but rather it was a perversion of the natural world through the wicked ways of science. Now, his explanation of the beast is as involved and narrativistic as the actual beast itself. So Newhouse claims this was not a hellhound. He says it wasn't something sent by the devil. He says it wasn't something come from the afterlife, but rather that it came out of the heart and mind of a true evil scientist. And this was his experiment gone right. Now, he paints the picture of a man named Dr. Gottlieb Hochmuller.
That's a mouthful. Thank goodness you read it.
I got you. Supposedly, this doctor was recently killed in a series of riots that occurred in Berlin, known as the Spartacist Uprising. Now, upon his death, secret papers were discovered that explained the exact origin of the Hound of Mons.
Oh, of course they were.
And Newhouse actually states in a article, I think it was for, well, he states originally in like the newspaper back in 1919 when this broke, but then again it's quoted in an article from Fortean Times. He basically says, like, this man has been revealed to Europe as the monster that he was through these secret papers that Newhouse supposedly had possession of, but unfortunately never made it to the light of day. Now, this scientist was filled with a patriotic desire to murder as many British soldiers as he could. The most efficient.
Naturally.
Yeah, naturally.
Any good German would.
Hello, German listeners.
I'm sorry.
We love you, and we don't think of you as monstrous killing machines. We're very grateful for your support. I'm sure we have at least one German listener.
I love your food. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he decided that the most efficient ways to kill a lot of British people, it's not to, like, invest in chemical warfare at the time. It's not to invest in better weaponry.
Really? Because that was pretty time-tested. That worked really well.
That did work fairly well. He decided that the best way to kill the most British people as he could was to create a fairy tale-like monster. So he spends months attempting to create some sort of ubermensch beast to do the bidding of the German army, but every single one of them fails. And he scours. He has finally his idea, his Mona Lisa of destruction.
Ooh.
And he scours the asylums and hospitals of Germany until he finds a patient whose hatred of the British had literally driven him insane, spending all of his time restrained due to his violent tendencies to lash out at anybody who he thought might be British, which at that point was literally everybody. He hated them so much, so they had to tie him up. Now, in conjunction with finding this individual, he searched long and far for the most vicious, brutal dog he could find, a real hound to cause his misery and destruction. When he has these two different pieces of the puzzle, he, in some sort of strange and brutal fashion, opens the head of the dog and opens the head of the patient and removes the brain of the madman and drops it into the head of the dog. Stop it. This is a serious story. Shut up.
Come on, man. Throw me a bone here. That's...
Hey. And,
As...
I'm not even done yet. As this dog, or as this man lay dying, he nurtures the dog and brings it up and feeds it special things to make it even bigger and even stronger. And then he unleashes it on the Britons at the Battle of Mons. But...
I love how he learned all the science to do this in months.
In months. And to be fair, we still can't. I mean, even if somebody wanted to do this, we couldn't do this. But he takes his creation and he unleashes it on the British army at the Battle of Mons. But the problem is his hubris got the best of him because, as you'll remember, the madman from the sanitarium, he had to be restrained even when in the presence of his German compatriots, because he was so hateful of the British that he figured he might as well just kill everyone. And as long as he got at least one British person, it was worth it for all the others. So this beast can't be tamed, can't be controlled, and it starts killing on both sides. Now, I put this in the notes, and I am going to read this.
Oh my god!
I put this in the notes like late last night because I was just feeling like sassy after that. So, because the beast couldn't tell the difference between German and British soldiers, and because of its hatred for Britain, it eventually just attacks everyone that it meets and kills them all equally. Which, if you think about it, it really speaks to the idea of us all being one human race, not distinctified by boundaries or nationality. We're all just people, and we're all just food for the murder machine.
That was eloquent. That was a beautiful. So that's freaking crazy.
I know. That's like, that is the, and it's probably going to be top by next week, but that is to date the craziest thing we've ever covered on this podcast.
And I mean, we've so talked about aliens.
Yeah,
and
we've
stuff.
Talked about a lot of stuff.
Portals for Bigfoot. Yeah.
We've talked about a lot of stuff.
So there's so much wrong with that. It's like watching Prometheus.
Right.
And all the wrong science involved with that as well. It's
still
the
never
same,
seen Prometheus.
Just
I want to, though.
Don't. Instead, watch like, I forgot who it is, but the YouTube channel that does everything wrong with blank movies. Just watch one of those and you'll see all the horrible science involved, which is what this story truly is. I mean, it's so far-fetched that it's...
Stop it.
It's horrible.
Yeah,
it is so horrible.
It's not... It like we said, it's not something that can happen in modern-day medicine. We mentioned the first head-to-body transplant is supposed to happen this year, but you couldn't take, even now, you could not take a brain alone and put it in a human body, much less if it's a human-to-human brain. I mean, if it's a human brain to a dog brain, that dog is going to be messed up. It's going to have anxiety. No, we don't want to do
that. It's not going to survive, Sam.
No,
it's not going to have anxiety. It's not going to be alive.
If it did survive, it would have a lot of anxiety.
Well, the human brain is not set up to control a dog's body.
Because I was thinking about it, and technically, I mean, maybe this is just makes sense to everybody else, but it didn't to me. I was thinking about this. If we did do a brain-to-brain transplant, like, let's say we took your brain and put it in my body for some reason, like, I would be you. I would have your mannerisms and your vocabulary and your tendencies. Like, it would be you in my body, which is very strange. And if you thought about taking a human brain and putting it in a dog's body, even if this guy is stark raving mad, he's going to be like, wait a second, I'm a dog now? What happened here? I was like,
I'm going to help everyone's leg.
You know, the other thing,
just
about,
enjoy it.
The other thing that I really like about this, the explanation of this story, is that it doesn't necessarily tell us what kind of dog. But we can infer that it is a primarily British dog now, or a German dog. Now, some people may go with the easy option, like a German Shepherd. Sure, big dogs, very, very brutal, and great at, well, they're not brutal, they're fantastic, but they're great at defending and all of that. But you know what else is another famous German type of dog?
Schnauzer?
The Dachshund.
Oh, It's Baron all along.
It's all Baron all along.
Dun, so dun, dun.
Because I was reading this, and even though it's obviously crazy, I get super freaked out reading about hellhounds and things in the middle of the night. And so I just had to take, and I just imagined my dog going out and just attacking people and running around and being a hellhound. And it was adorable.
See, I love how you imagine him like that. And I imagine him as like the Red Baron flying around in a teeny tiny biplane.
Right. There you go.
That's how I see him.
He'd be really good. Anyway. Well, but we did. I mean, we, apart from that insanity.
That was lovely.
That was lovely, wasn't it? Apart from that insanity, I mean, you made some really good points, actually, as to the physical presence of a dog on a battlefield. Like, that is something that could absolutely happen.
It did happen.
Yeah.
In multiple different roles, Sam.
Yeah. So,
to give you an idea, German forces actually employed 30,000 dogs.
Right. I'm not saying that dogs did not. I'm saying, like, the Hound of Mons being just a dog on the battlefield. Which, I mean, if we're gonna, I think that the story has some credit to it. I do. There's been a lot of people who came back and said, like, Newhouse isn't lying necessarily, but what he is experiencing is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he's associated it with this giant beast when in reality it was just the horrors of war, which is entirely possible. But the thing about Mons, the Battle of Mons, is it was a supernatural sight. There was also, we didn't really mention it at all here, but there was a certain point during the battle, like I said, the British actually did lose the battle, but they held it quite well. They were outnumbered, I think, 4-1, and they killed 4 times as many German soldiers as British soldiers. There was a point in the battle where some soldiers described seeing bowmen in the clouds. The clouds opened and they saw basically angels with bows firing down at the Germans. And it got to the point where this story, the Bowmen of Mons, it got to the point where this story was a part of the national identity. And to question it was basically, like, not actually, but pretty close to treason. When you're saying, like, well, maybe these people weren't defended by angels. And they're like, well, they were. So Mons itself was a very, very supernaturally charged event anyway. I mean, while I totally agree with your interpretation that there could just be a dog, and that probably is Occam's razor's the most likely thing, other than
I try to make
nothing.
The least amount of assumptions.
Right. And I try to make the most amount of assumptions.
I know.
And
I know.
That's what works here. I think that, like I said, I have never heard of a better environment for a hellhound than No Man's Land.
It is.
It's poetic.
Beautiful.
In its own way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with that. 110%.
All right.
So you think it was actually a supernatural beast?
I'm going to say yeah.
You're leaning towards it? Okay.
If it happened, if it wasn't simply a tragic case of post-traumatic stress disorder on Newhouse's part, if there's truth to the story in its current form, I would say yeah. I'd say it's a hellhound. Okay. I'm going to say it. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, and I touched on this before we actually started the show, mm-hmm. I think it could literally be just like a crossbreed of a wolf and like a Belgian shepherd, which for our listeners, if you haven't seen one and if you're not a big dog buff, they're absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Very wolf-like, long, shaggy hair, like a German shepherd, a little bit longer than that though. And typically straight black with brown eyes. So I truly think it might have been a very advantageous dog, or again, like a hybrid, maybe. That is literally the Blackbeard of Mons.
I mean, that's fine. I had no idea what you had said about Blackbeard.
So
I think I had seen
freaking cool.
Now
right?
that I think of it, I've seen a picture of that, but I had no idea. That is amazing. All right.
Yeah, dude. I'm gonna rack it up to advantageous dogs.
All right. I think that's fair too. In any case, it's creepy. It's weird.
Oh yeah, like, super creepy.
Whether it's a hellhound or whether it was just a dog just preying on soldiers, mm-hmm. it's still terrifying. And I hope everyone
can
sleep well tonight.
I think this was a really cool story.
Yeah.
I think we've learned a lot on both sides here today. Anything else that we need to talk about today with Mons?
I can't think of anything, man. I think
wonderful.
We did it.
All right.
We did it.
Sweet. Let's
the Hound of Mons.
Let's dig into the next step here.
Yep.
What else are we talking about today, Sam?
So we have, well, like always, we wanna give a shout out to anybody who left us a review. So I'm gonna do that now. Also, by the way, Jason, I'm gonna tell you this. I don't think you know. We have been.
I don't know anything, Sam.
That's okay, Jon Snow.
You don't tell me anything. I learned from Facebook like the rest of the world.
If you asked, you would know more. We've been on the top 200 for society and culture for like the last 24 hours, maybe even a little longer.
Yes.
So we like got as high.
200 or 99?
Well, we got as high as 166, I think.
Sweet.
Yeah, and then now we're sitting at like 86. I'm sure that by the time the show comes out, we'll be off again, and that's fine.
Like 186 or 86.
One right now we're at 186.
Okay.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah. Jason almost had a freaking heart attack.
Okay.
But really quick, let's go ahead. I'm gonna shout out the people who left us reviews. So let me just get there really quick. Do 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 do. All right. So we have DL Considine. Thank you, DL Considine. And we have Sample MM. Thank you both for your great reviews. I'm going to read DL's because it is another cool thing that I wanted to mention, even though it's really not like that important, but it's probably the coolest thing that ever happened in my life. So he says, they say, I don't want to assume anyone's gender here. They say, I heard about this podcast. No, they titled it Best Hour Spent Listening to Spooky Things, which I think is fair. I think that's a good compliment. He says, I heard about this podcast from Astonishing Legends, and they were spot on. This is a great, funny, and informative podcast. While I've only listened to one episode so far, The Chupacabra, I am
yes!
hooked.
Yes! Yes! Check out the Sea Monsters.
There
it
we
gets
go.
Better.
Jason Special Part 2. This is now one of my top podcasts to listen to, and I look forward to more, more, more. Thank you so much. I chose that review for two reasons. The first is it's really nice, and I like it a lot. The second is that he says, I heard about this podcast from Astonishing Legends. I was listening.
Your heroes.
My heroes. The Podfathers. I was listening to their newest episode, and at one point, they don't like give us a shout out or anything, but at one point, they're talking about, Forrest is talking about like a conversation on Twitter that he was having, and he says like, there was a few of us on Twitter having a conversation, members of our research corps and the Not Alone podcast, and I died. I, like, passed out. I was like, what? So that was really cool. That was, like, the cool thing of the week for me. So thank you so much for your reviews, guys. And then we actually got a few new patrons this month as well. As for our new patrons, we have Enma Wagster.
Yay, Enma!
We have Teresa Moitoso.
Yeah, Mom!
There we go.
And Dad. I know Dad's a part of that, too.
There we go. We have David Crabtree.
Yeah, David!
And we have... You're okay. We have Nicole White.
Yay, Nicole!
And Nicole is actually my cousin. So she... yeah, that's cool. Hi, cuz.
Sup.
So, guys, if you want to support the show, the Patreon is a good way to do it. The leaving reviews is a good way to do it. Leaving reviews allows us to get better recommended by other people. It allows us to, in theory, show up better in like the search algorithms, the top 200 charts and things like that.
Yeah, and of course, this feedback is great for us.
Yeah,
that's 110%.
We have taken every single review that we've gotten so far, and we have used it to help give you more of what you like. So if you like what we do, leave a review. But we also know some people prefer to do a little more than that. If that's the case, we do have our Patreon set up. It's patreon.com/notalonepodcast. You can go donate $1, $3, or $5 a month, whatever the show's worth to you. You get bonus episodes and extended editions of the shows and little debriefs. We've tried our best to make it, you know, valuable to anybody. We also just set up a Discord server where if you pledge $3 or more a month, you can actually now suggest topics for the shows, the bonus episodes, as well as some of these that we're getting are really good, and we're going to probably make them into real.
So Sam, how do our listeners become a part of that Discord server?
You would sign up for a $3 or above level, and then I will email you an invitation code. Essentially, you download the Discord app, you click the link in the code, and it'll take you right in.
Okay,
so,
cool.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. So those are two good ways of supporting the show. Really, I mean, your best way to support the show, though, is just to listen. Just download it, especially tell your friends. We have had, Jason, I don't think I've told you about any of this. I've had multiple people since our local legend special come out.
Dude, you leave me in the dark about everything, don't you?
Well, it's because I'm living a full and rich life over here, and I've got a lot of things going on, and I don't always remember to text you.
That's fair.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's okay.
I've had at least two people, yeah, since the local legends episode came out. One of them was Mark. Mark was telling me he was at a party, and somebody was talking to him and saying, or talking to somebody else and said, oh, I just found this great local podcast called Not Alone. And I was like, Mark, you're lying to me. And he's like, no, dude. And then another one, my sister-in-law's fiance's sister, follow that.
Okay.
She was saying that she was at work. All she does is listen to podcasts at work. She was at work and she heard somebody else listening to our show and came over and they were like, oh, do you know this show? She's like, yes, I know this show. I love this show. So like, guys, telling your friends is the one of the best ways to support us. You know, just the more we grow, the more we can invest in the show, the more we can have time to do this. And it just feels nice too, looking at our numbers. It's a good feeling.
It's so weird.
It is very strange.
Thank y'all.
Yeah, and I think this last week as well. Yeah, this, right?
Maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know. Something else you forgot to tell me about?
No, I told you about this. This last week as well, we hit 100,000 downloads total.
Yes.
So that was dope. If I edited this correctly, you're going to hear the show start with me mentioning a survey that we'd like you to do. It takes about 26 seconds. I'm going to put a link in the show notes, and this time the link is going to work. So just head over to that survey. It's survey.libsyn.com/notalonepodcast. Just helps us to learn a little more about you guys. It's mainly just a demographic survey.
How do you spell Libsyn? Is it Libsyn?
LIBSYN.com. No, wait, crap. It's survey. That is SURVEY.LIBSYN.com/notalonepodcast. There you go.
Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome, Dad. So,
I'm sorry. Go back. There you go, Mom.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So, yeah, I'll put a, like I said, I'm going to record something about that. But take a look at that. Takes you 30 seconds. If you could do that for us, we'd greatly appreciate it. But guys, as you know, you don't have to do any of that. You just have to be our listeners.
And we just don't want to be alone.
We love you forever. Yeah, we don't. And that's a good point. We're not alone. The podcast. Cool. Anything you got? Anything on your end?
I think we're set, man.
All right.
That was a good day.
This has
some great, great stories and some more crazy information about our ancestry.
Yeah, there we go. So.
Did I say it last week?
You did say it last week. I remember because I wanted to say it last week.
That's right. That's
because
right.
It was the local legend show, but you did. Yep. So, remember. Whether in the dark, prehistoric night, watching a pair of eyes watch you from the darkness, or in the trenches of World War I, huddled together in fear of the beast lurking in no man's land, we are
not alone.